welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zara-Kopinski. This week, Doug Burgess joins me to discuss his book, Fogland Point. This book is my favorite kind of mystery. Quirky small town, richly drawn characters, and a plot that keeps me guessing. It was such a treat to get to dive into the backstory of this book with Doug, and to hear more about the setting he brings to life, which is extra special to my heart, Little Compton, Rhode Island, right next door to where I grew up. Doug Burgess, welcome to A Bookish Home.
Thank you. Good to be there.
Yeah, I'm really excited to get to speak with you. Congratulations on the book. I enjoyed Fogland Point so much. It is a mystery I definitely did not want to put down. And for readers who haven't read it yet, I was hoping you could just tell us a little bit about the book.
Oh, sure, of course. So it's the story of a young man who is brought home to care for his grandmother, who's been diagnosed with dementia in a small town in Rhode Island that he left under forced circumstances some years before and had no intention of going back to. So he goes back to take care of her, and he discovers a body in the house next door, and he finds out that his grandmother might be a key witness to this, but because of the uncertainty of her memories, he can't tell if she's describing a murder that she saw yesterday or 50 years ago or both. So in the process of trying to unravel the mystery next door, he begins to find out about something else very similar that happened quite some time ago.
It's so good. One of the reasons I had been so drawn to it and had picked it up originally is you're saying it's set in a small town in Rhode Island. It's set in Little Compton, which is right next door to where I grew up. I grew up in Westport, Mass. And as you're probably aware, you don't see lots of books set there. And you kind of write a little bit in the book about how it's an area where when you're living there, you kind of feel like you're in the middle of nowhere and not much is going on. But I'm curious what your experience was in the area. I think it said in the author's note you grew up nearby.
I did. And as a matter of fact, my family had a farm in Little Compton going all the way back to the 1730s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And there's all of these wonderful pictures from the 1890s up until the 1950s. Of them going out to the farm, and then they would use it as a summer house and everything. So, but I hadn't actually been there, even though it's only about maybe 40 miles away from my parents' house. I hadn't been there until I was an adult. And the first time we went out, there's a strange kind of quirk that because of where it's located, it's sort of on a peninsula that sticks out into the bay. You go all the way due south, and then you go out onto this little spit of land, and the weather changes. So the first time I came into Little Compton, it had been an absolutely beautiful sunny day in Newport, and then the moment that we crossed into Little Compton, the fog rolled in. And every single time I've been there, with almost no exceptions, it's been the same story. So I just remember thinking even then, what a wonderful place this would be for a mystery. I took a picture of an old colonial house in a big barren field with a big sort of cloud of fog rolling past it. And I saved that picture and I would look at it every now and then as I was writing to kind of draw inspiration from it.
Oh, wow. And so is that how, I mean, I was curious if that setting had sort of been what you had first in mind before, I know you're saying you thought it would be a good place for a mystery. It was that sort of the first element, just getting that sense of place?
Actually, I think the first element was the characters, because I drew so much from the people that I grew up with. And as you say, there's not that many books or mysteries set in New England generally. And New England is the best place in the world for a mystery because everyone's keeping secrets. And I remember growing up with this strange duality where New England architecture, when you go into a little New England town, everything is stark, simple, clean. You know, my parents live in this place called Kingston, and it's all of these beautiful little salt box colonials with perfectly manicured yards, but everybody's got a big picket fence that hides whatever is in the backyard because that's what they don't want people to see. And that's kind of how I grew up is, you know, in my family and all of our friends, if something was going on, if there was a divorce, infidelity, you know, even things like cancer, you just never talked about it. So mm-hmm. having that kind of, you know, the face that you put on for company, and then the reality behind, I always thought, wow, New Englanders would make great murder suspects.
Well, you definitely get that sense as you're reading that, yes, for sure, everyone is keeping things to themselves. And as you go along, every little twist and turn, you learn a new secret, which definitely is part of what kept me turning the pages as a reader. I kept wanting to know, oh my goodness, what's going to happen next? And as I was reading, it was striking me how difficult it must have been to sort of keep track of all that and map it out as all these different layers are unraveling. Can you talk a little bit about what the writing process was like in terms of sort of unfolding that mystery?
Well, sure. I think now I have more respect than ever for J.K. Rowling, because I had to do this in something that was about 300 pages. And I think she's written like 5,000 pages of Harry Potter and had to keep every single character consistent, have no mistakes, have no inconsistencies. And I don't know how someone does it. I don't know how I did it. I can say in terms of the process, though, it began with a short story that I wrote many years ago when I was in college. That was very simple. It was just about a lady living in a little New England town that sent letters to herself. And everyone in the town knew it. But because it's New England, nobody admitted that they knew it. And then that story, you know, it got a couple of awards and I sort of put it away. And then I dug it out again, I think around 2008, and turned it into a short story for Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. So I added the character of Maggie, the grandmother, and the element of dementia and sort of the unreliable narrator, and then really liked where that went. So that became the basis for the novel. So you can imagine, like, each layer, every time I added new characters, you know, a new subplot or whatever, I had to go back and kind of stitch together all of the threads again, mm-hmm. to make sure that all of these characters were behaving in a way that was consistent throughout. And there's still, you know, even now I go back and I think, oh, I really should have changed that. Or, you know, just like, oh, that should be, you know, that could be a little bit tighter or whatever. But no, in terms of like keeping it consistent, strangely enough, that kind of worked itself through just as I was writing it. Because, you know, if I was going to go in and add an element, like the whole story of Billy, Sheriff Dyer, that actually didn't exist in the original draft. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted that character. So I thought, okay, how can I do this? And then I just sort of worked him in. And then you go out, you know, you kind of go in afterwards and, you know, clean up all the little scraps and stuff. And hopefully it works.
That's so interesting. And did you make a lot of trips to Little Compton while you were writing? Or is that something that you, I know I had read in an interview that you had already done a lot of local history research before you started the book.
Well, I did go to Little Compton quite a bit to make sure that I was describing all the places accurately. And in a way, not just Little Compton, but throughout Rhode Island, there's a kind of, I would say like a uniformity to a lot of the characters that you find in Rhode Island. So I didn't necessarily have to go to Little Compton and speak to someone there to get a sense of, you know, the Laughing Sarahs. Actually, the Laughing Sarahs, that name is the name of the church group that my mother belongs to. It's a bunch of ladies past the age of 50, and I just loved the name. So a lot of it was actually drawn not only from Little Compton, but from Kingston, Narragansett, Providence, everywhere. But definitely mm-hmm. in terms of trying to set the scene, even things like I would ask to go into people's houses, not in Little Compton, but I'd sort of bother my friends. If anybody I knew that had an old colonial house, I would walk around with my iPhone and take pictures of random things like cup holders and little weird staircases and things like that, just to try and be able to describe the homes that these people lived in and make it as accurate as possible.
That's so interesting. I mean, it just has such a strong sense of place. And as I was reading, it was funny. I think at one point you mentioned like a general store and how it's more set up for the tourists. And I was laughing. I don't know if this is the one you were talking about, but it was reminding me I worked at Simmons store in Little Compton when I was in high school, and it was that sort of thing. Yeah, it had, you know, penny candy and sandwiches and things, but I think you made a, there was a line about like, it didn't have pasta sauce or something, and now they've got to drive 15 more minutes away because it's not the quaint, yeah. It's a quaint general store, not as practical. And, but it's funny. And it, I think in here it was talking too about how, you know, it's that interesting dynamic in some of these towns, and Westport is like that too, where it's the locals most of the year, but then tourists come in the summer. And in a lot of ways, it is even now kind of sort of a hidden spot. I don't think it's as well known to tourists, but the people that do come, there's sort of an interesting dynamic. And I feel like you feel that in the book a little bit too, like you... they sort of need those summer people, but also kind of resent them a little bit. And when we were talking a little bit about the Laughing Sarahs, I really thought they're, well, for people who haven't read it yet, those are the main characters, sort of his, not by blood, but his sort of aunts, his grandmother's friends. And they had such interesting relationships and seem so loyal to each other, but at the same time, there were definitely some, you know, dark elements of their relationship. I think this with all your characters, they're not sort of the cookie cutter small town story characters. They had a lot of depth to them. And I was curious, as you were writing, did it take a long time to flesh each of them out individually and really get a clear sense of who they were?
It's interesting. I think I had a clear sense of who they were, but I didn't necessarily know their whole story. You know, so much of these of all of the characters in this book are drawn from my family, and not just family that I knew, but descriptions of you know, my great grandmother and her circle of friends. And I grew up with all of these family stories, and it's actually a little bit macabre because most of the people that I was hearing stories about had died 30, 40, or 50 years before I was even born. So hearing those stories, and a lot of those stories kind of worked themselves into the novel, and seeing how my grandparents were, you know, my grandmother had a very close circle of friends, and after she passed away, they were the ones that ended up filling in a lot of the gaps. We only heard like half of all the stories, and then they would come and say, oh, actually, you know. So in a sense, I knew who these people were. So someone like Aunt Constance. Aunt Constance was my elementary school teacher. She was the town librarian. She was the lady that ran the plant store on Route 138. I've seen so many Aunt Constances that it wasn't hard to get a sense of who she was because I remembered all of those people, and kind of combined them in my head, and that became her. So mm-hmm. Yeah, in a sense they were, I could see them very clearly because I grew up with them.
That's interesting. And I think maybe as a reader, at least I maybe sort of pick up on that as well and associate her with people I've known. so maybe that also adds some depth there, which is interesting. And kind of woven throughout the individual Laughing Sarah stories, but sort of mixed in there are sort of stories of local history and characters from way in the past in sort of the family lore. And I was curious about some of that and kind of where fiction met reality a little bit, like if there is some truth in some of these old tales that are kind of woven in.
Mm-hmm. When I was about, I think maybe 7 or 8 years old, my dad drove me out to Rough Point in Newport. And he pointed, it was sort of midwinter. It was really, really cold. And he pointed out to the horizon. He said, you wait. There's going to be a fireball. And he was very serious about this. And he said that and he told me this story about a ship that had wrecked against the rocks and caught fire. And that every year on the same day, you could see the glow, this little faint glow on the horizon of the ship going down. And that never left me. And I wish I could say that I actually saw the glow, but I think I claimed to see it. I don't know if I actually saw it. But Rhode Island is absolutely filled with stories like that. And the other thing that I wanted to convey in the novel is that when I say in the novel that every New England house has a ghost, that's basically true, but it's also really boring. People have this idea that, you know, when you say, oh, my house is haunted, like, oh, wow, does stuff move around at night? It's like, no, not really. I just can't ever find anything.
You know? It's so funny that you say that. And I that line in the book I thought was interesting. So my family, the house next door to where I grew up, was sort of like the family farmhouse that my great-grandfather lived in the early 1900s when they came over from Poland. And it's so true. I kind of take this for granted. But yes, growing up, it was just assumed like, oh, yeah, there's some sort of ghost there. And people have smelled like an old woman's perfume. Or one night, my brother-in-law heard something crashing down the cellar stairs, but nobody else was home. But yeah, no one is really phased by that for some reason. It's funny that you say that.
And that gets to a point that you were making earlier about, you know, when you were talking about Rhode Islanders and New Englanders generally having to deal with the summer invasion. It's so funny that I live in New York now, because I grew up knowing nothing about New Yorkers except that they were the reason we couldn't get into a restaurant from May to the end of August. And when I moved here, I would have these conversations with friends that they were like, wait, but your house was haunted? I'm like, well, yeah, it was haunted. And then I would tell them some of the stories that, you know, that I grew up with. And it never occurred to me that any of these things were unusual, especially the sort of supernatural aspect of it. If it's something that is with you every day, you don't find it all that remarkable. I mean, my partner said to me one time, you know, you had to come to that house. You had to go back into the house alone at night. You know, what was that like? I said, actually, it felt pretty good because, you know, I wasn't alone.
Yep. So, yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think even, so I lived there pretty much my whole life, and I moved to New York for a few years after college. And I think that's when too, I started to see it a little bit differently, because I think you even maybe take for granted sort of like the natural beauty and just sort of what you're near. I mean, you're basically in these farm towns that are also beach towns, which is sort of unusual. And even though there's not a lot around there, I mean, just, you know, stunning places. And I think I just sort of took for granted growing up that everyone can drive 5 minutes to a beach you know, has this beautiful land. And yeah, it's interesting. I think it does sometimes take moving away to see it differently. And it was making me think of too, as I was reading, I was curious, I don't know if this got mentioned in the book, or maybe this was just a Westport thing, not a Little Compton thing, but those, we always called the New York people or the out of towners skooks. I don't know if you ever heard that.
No, I don't know that one.
So I used to work at the Village Corn Crib in Westport, which was like a farm stand, but we actually would drive to Little Compton for the corn. But the people that came in who would tell us, you know, how cute it was and, you know, whatever, they would be called skooks. And even though you relied on them for business, you also sort of, you know, found them irritating. But then you move away and you realize, well, I'm kind of a skook now when I come back. So
it's true. I think we do notice how that changes. Yeah, I've noticed. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could have written the book if I had never left Rhode Island. Because actually, you know, I'm only 3.5 hours away. So coming back, I would be able to look at it again with sort of a fresh pair of eyes. And like what you're talking about with the natural beauty, I never realized how pretty it was either. Especially, I went to high school on the east side in Providence. And to me, that was a place like, oh gosh, I gotta go back there again. And then, you know, I come back now, it's like, wow, Benefit Street's beautiful. Why didn't I ever notice any of this? You know, so it is different.
Well, it's interesting. It sort of parallels, and I wanted to get back to the main character. So David's the main character, and he's sort of experiencing that too. He's coming back to Little Compton after being away. Was he teaching in New York? Is that where he was before?
Boston, actually.
He was in Boston. Okay. So he, I don't think it's giving anything away to say he loses his job and comes back to Little Compton at the same time as the murder. So he's going to check on his grandmother anyway. And he hasn't been back to town for several years, I think. So he's sort of seeing it with new eyes too. Was that something that you were thinking about before you were writing, kind of giving the main character a little bit of that space as well, like having it not be someone that has never left the town?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because I was thinking about it from the perspective of the reader, too. It would be much harder for the reader to be dropped into the middle of this town with a local that already knows all the rules. Because remember, the local is trying to tell you. He's the one that's telling you the story. So if he already knows how everything works, he may not necessarily be the best person to explain it to you. But if you are with someone, if you're sort of on, you know, following along on the shoulder of someone that's coming back to this place and experiencing these, all these things anew, then the way that he's going to respond to them, you as a reader will respond from the same way. So yes, I really had to think about that when I had David come home. I had to remember what it was like, especially, you know, when I was in college and I'd be gone for a year or more at a time, to come back for something like Christmas and to have the familiarity also seem remarkably strange, that you'd come back to a house that you hadn't seen for, you know, quite some time, and everything be exactly as it was. And it does weird things to your sense of place and memory to come back. And, you know, even now I'm 41 years old. And every time I go back to my parents' house, my mother always manages to remind me to put the toilet seat down every single time. And you go instantly back to being 13 years old again. And I kind of wanted to play with that too, because David, as you know, is a very different person now than he was when he left. And to go back to that room, you know, that's like pink with all the ruffles and everything, and have to have that be his room again, I really wanted to kind of play with that idea.
Yeah, that's, it just creates such an interesting dynamic. And you're mentioning how different things are when he's moving back. One of the things I thought was just an interesting choice as a writer, we sort of read the first bit of the book from David's point of view, but it's not until time goes on a little bit that we find out that he's actually transgender, which I thought was really interesting as a reader, just the way that sort of like evolves a little bit in the story as you're reading. Can you talk about why you made that choice?
Oh, sure. It actually comes out of a very close friend that I have, who is transgender, and I knew him for almost 2 years before I knew, because it's not like someone comes up to you and shakes your hand and says, "Hey, by the way, I'm trans."
Right.
The way that we individually experience trans culture is that we often don't know that someone that we know quite well is trans. I thought, if I'm going to write this from the perspective of a trans man, it would be unrealistic. It wouldn't be true to the character to introduce on the very first page, you know, "Hi, I'm David and I'm trans." That's not how he is experiencing. That's not what's the foremost thing in his mind. The foremost thing in his mind is his grandmother is ill and he's going home to take care of her. And the trans thing is something that it's there. It's certainly, he's going to have to deal with a lot of emotions connected to it once he comes home. But I wanted you to experience those emotions kind of in real time as he's experiencing them. I didn't want to lay the groundwork, so to speak. And you know, that was all that was in my mind. But then when I started to read some of the reviews, someone said that she loved that every single person in the novel is not who you think they are when you start to read about them. I thought, yeah, that's kind of true.
That is true. That. Yeah. I just thought that was really an interesting experience to have as a reader. And, you know, I like how you're saying, it's what I picked up on as a reader, that it's not presented as if this is the foremost thing about him, because it's not. It's one aspect of who he is, and I feel like that's handled, that's how it's handled in the writing. And I feel like we think a lot for kids about, you know, offering a variety of perspectives and reading a book and kind of walking in someone else's shoes. And I don't know that that gets talked about quite enough for adults. And it was especially on my mind as I was reading. This probably won't air until well after the election, but I'm in Massachusetts, which, you know, Little Compton is right on the border, so it's relevant there too. But we have a ballot question coming up about keeping anti-discrimination protection for transgender people, which I'm very much in favor of. And I felt like as I was reading, you know, there's been a lot of fear mongering going on as this ballot question comes up. And I just felt like, you know, if there were more stories or people picking up a book where they are just, you know, walking in someone else's shoes, who is transgender and, you know, open people's hearts a little bit. I just felt, I don't know, I've been discouraged to see some of the reactions coming up as this ballot question gets closer. So I don't know if that was on your mind at all when you were writing.
It really was. You know, in my day job, I'm a university professor. And I had to teach a U.S. history class the day after the 2016 election. And it ended up turning into a grief counseling session, because other than their parents and, you know, their friends, I was the only other person that they really had to bounce ideas off of. And because I'm wearing a jacket and sitting in a big lecture hall, they assumed that I would know something. And there was a tremendous sense, you know, that I had it, all my friends had it, everyone I knew had it. This tremendous sense, not only of anger, but also of helplessness, that we all wanted to do something, but there really wasn't that much, you know, aside from the things that we would normally do anyway, that we could do, vote, agitate. And when I started working on this novel, the original idea would have been that the character would be sort of more closely of an avatar of myself. He would be gay and whatever. But then the more I thought about it, I thought, no. First of all, it doesn't need to be autobiographical. Secondly, that's not really breaking any new ground. And, you know, there would be nothing remarkable about an openly gay man coming back to Little Compton. That's just not interesting. Like, it's nice, fine, you know.
Right.
I come back to Kingston every few months or so, but it doesn't do anything really. But what was foremost in my mind as I was writing this was I was thinking, somewhere, someone's going to pick up this book because it's a mystery and it's, you know, it's got a spooky image on the cover. And they're going to read it and they're going to hit that. And that is, and they're not going to expect it. And I really hope I've written the first 40 pages well enough so that when they hit that and the surprise comes, and it may be something that they didn't expect and might not have bought the book if they had known, that they keep reading.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the reader I had in mind. And actually, I pay really close attention to all of the online reader reviews. And I've seen, through those reviews, I've seen both kinds of reaction. I've seen people who said, wow, I wasn't expecting that, but, you know, I've got a new perspective or whatever. And then some of the negative reviews, like, he didn't have to have that. Why do you have to have that? That just changed the whole story. I was like, okay, you know, you can't reach everyone. But
right.
But that was, I really wanted that because that's how, I think that is how we change someone's mind. That is how we reach someone, is you can't always sit them down and say, now this is how the society works. You know, sometimes you just have to kind of jump out of the shadows. And I think that's what the book is doing, is like, you're reading this novel and all of a sudden, oh, wow, okay, that's where this is going.
Yeah, and I think in some ways, a book is such a powerful way to do that because you're literally like experiencing the world through their eyes. So I think that can be a really powerful experience. And, you know, I'm sure for every negative reaction, you're hopefully going to receive lots and lots of positive ones.
Oh, yeah.
And I was curious too, if you have done any like local readings or anything, or if you, you know, have been talking about the book with people in Little Compton or that area?
Oddly enough, Little Compton, no. We had a book event in New York that a few people came down to from Rhode Island. And actually, There's going to be an event in Providence a bit later that's still yet to be scheduled, but I don't even know if anybody in Little Compton knows it exists yet. So, which would be kind of funny, but.
Yeah, well, I was noticing, you know, right over the line in Westport, Partners Village Store has been doing some book events. So I was like, oh, I wonder if he's going to do a reading there. So that might be interesting. I bet they'd get some locals. I guess I just was also curious. I always love to find out from writers kind of what your writing routine is like. I know you're also a professor too. How do you manage to fit all that in, and what's your routine like?
Well, it's very different to write fiction. It's easier and harder. It's easier than writing history because you get to lie. When you write history, I'm actually standing in my own office in my apartment right now, and my office consists of a giant leather chair and a side table and about five or six giant stacks of books, most of which have toppled over. So my writing process for history is I sit in the chair and I grab whatever book I need and I find a citation and I write like that. With a novel, it was kind of liberating because I didn't have to fact check. I did research, obviously, but it was so much more fun because I could just kind of let my imagination run wild. So it, unlike, you know, when I write for academia, there's a sort of a discipline to it. I have a cup of coffee and I sit down and I schedule, this is the amount of time I'm going to spend today working on this. With the novel, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was, I would actually, some of the best ideas I had, actually most of the plot twists and things, I would be jogging through Prospect Park and pull out my iPhone and stop jogging for a minute and make a note. And I ended up having at least like 50 or 60 of those notes by the end of it. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a completely different experience. Because it wasn't something that I said, I have to do this right now. I have to sit down and do this. It was whenever I had a free minute and whenever the idea came into my head, I'd, you know, pull the book out and start working on it again. So it was much more organic, I think, than any of the nonfiction.
That's so interesting. I always love hearing, like, some people I've talked to have said, oh, I get up right away before I do anything else. It's 2,000 words. And others, I mean, there's just so many different ways of working and ways that, I guess, inspiration strikes. So that's so interesting that for you, it's all these sort of stolen bits of time. Are there particular mysteries that have inspired you? Were you always sort of a mystery fan, or what kind of led you in that direction?
Oh, I've always been a mystery fan. And actually, one of my earliest memories was my grandfather reading Murder on the Orient Express to me as a kid. I think I might have been like 6 or 7 years old. So, and I grew up with the movies. I think I actually went as Hercule Poirot for Halloween one year, the Peter Ustinov version.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember because I had a pillow under my shirt and everything, and like a three-piece suit. So I got trained on the classics. Start off with Christie, and then moved on to Dorothy Sayers, and then by the time I got to college, I started reading more of Nio Marsh. Have you ever read anything by her?
I have not.
Oh, she's amazing. It's so funny because everybody talks about Christie. Some people talk about Sayers, you know, a little bit like Margaret Allingham. But Nio Marsh, she was actually born and raised in New Zealand, but spent the majority of her adult years in England. And she wrote all the way from the 1930s to the 1980s. So she had an even longer career than Christie did. She's the only novelist, mystery or otherwise, the only one whose writing actually got better as she aged. Like, some of her very last books were her absolute best.
Hmm.
And the
Is
thing
there, if,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask if someone was going to start with one of hers, because I can link to these in the show notes. Is there a particular one you would recommend?
Yes. Actually, there's two. There's one that's called Death of a Peer, sometimes published. It's the easy name to find it under is Death of a Peer, as in P-E-E-R. And it was originally published with a sort of complex British title as A Surfeit of Lampreys, but, you know, don't even bother with that one. So that one, and then there's another one called Dead Water. Both of those are phenomenal. And what makes them so good is these were the first mysteries that I had ever read where the characters were much more important than the body in the, you know, in the library kind of thing, you know? It wasn't just about alibis and everything else, and it wasn't the sort of stock collection of people at a lodge for a hunting party. It was, these are people that have real lives and emotions. And in a sense, the detective is kind of incidental to the plot. And I loved that. And I think that's something that I kind of wanted to work into Fogland Point, was that it is a mystery, and people are reading it as a mystery. And that's, I wanted to be able to give them that. But when I was writing it, it was more important to me to make it believable, to make the place real in the same way that, that Niall Marsh had done.
Well, I was just going to say that's exactly how I felt about your book, because I don't normally tend to gravitate towards mysteries, but, I think because it does have, that really strong sense of place. And yes, there's a mystery, but you're also revealing all these things about the characters and their lives. Yes, I think that really comes through. And in a way, it reminds me the other mystery that I had gotten into in recent years, of the Louise Penny books. And that sort of was on my mind too, that idea of, you know, you're in this small town and there's this whole cast of characters. And So I know there's a lot of Louise Penny fans out there, so I would say this would be a good one to try. And then I guess just lastly, are there any books you've been reading lately that you would want to recommend to listeners? I always love to hear what authors are reading.
Oh, sure. Actually, I just finished, I think it's a few years old now, but Stephen Saylor's book, The Judgment of Caesar. And I know he's got a new one coming out, I think this year. It might even be out now. He's the one that does the Roma Sub Rosa series. So it's Roman mysteries set right about the time of the end of the Republic. And he's been writing them since at least the 80s. And I think this might be the one that's coming out this year. I think might be his last. There's been some rumors that it is. And they're
very cool.
They're wonderful. They're really, really good. So I would certainly recommend him.
I will definitely link to those. And if people want to learn more about you or your book, is there somewhere I could direct people?
Oh, sure. So actually, there'll be two things. The Poison Pen Press is maintaining a website, and they will update it with any events and stuff. I also have an Instagram page, which is called Fogland Point, one word. And if there's any events, especially in New England or the tri-state area, I will always post something about that on the Instagram page.
Oh, great. I will definitely link to both of those. Well, Doug, thank you so much for talking with me. And I definitely recommend that readers head to their local bookstore or library to pick up Fogland Point. It would be a great book to curl up with as it's now getting cold and dive into a New England mystery. So just thanks for being on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I hope you head over to your local library or bookstore to pick up a copy of Fogland Point. You can follow Doug on Instagram at Fogland Point, and I will also link to Poison Pen's website for Fogland Point in the show notes at abookishhome.com. There you will also find links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to share it with a friend and rate or review on iTunes. It would be so helpful if you could take a moment to help people find the show. And if you decide to read a book mentioned on the blog or podcast, I would love to hear. You can tag me on Twitter or Instagram at A Bookish Home, and you can also follow me there to stay up to date on all my bookish happenings. Thanks for listening, and happy reading!